Do you remember what you got on your SAT? I remember that I once fell asleep taking the SAT. True story. Sad, but true. Sean Fidel doesn't have to remember what he got on the test that determines the direction that a lot of lives go, because the world basically remembers for him. That's what happens when you get a perfect score. Sean grew up in a motel in what he describes as the seedy side of Las Vegas. He was a good student, but he wasn't necessarily the kid that you would say, that's the guy who's going to get the perfect score. But one day, after an okay score on his first attempt at the test, he decided to try to crack the code on doing better. He didn't do better. He did perfect. And that, friends, was a game changer that opened doors he never could have imagined, from having the Ivy Leagues drooling over him to one day ending up on Shark Tank after he created a company called Prep Expert to help other kids do better on the test that is arguably the gold standard for college admissions. Now, I say arguably because COVID, shocker, is affecting college admissions. Maybe more than Aunt Becky did. The UC schools are suspending the use of the SAT and ACT in admissions until at least 2024, and we did record this episode right before that happened. On this, dying to ask, how Sean cracked the test. Why, even though he's in the 0.02% of people who have taken the current form of the SAT and gotten a perfect score, he's the first to say he is not a genius. He's now a doctor, still running Prep Expert on the side, what he learns from his weekly chats with Mark Cuban, and why his story is really the story of using what you've got to get what you want. But here's the thing, you've got to know what you want. This guy is as fun as he is smart, and I hope you enjoy the conversation with Sean Fidel on this week's Dying to Ask. My name is Deirdre Fitzpatrick. I'm a TV news anchor, a mom of two boys, a wife, a runner, a total book nerd, and I can't stop asking questions, like ever. I'm obsessed with knowing, how do people do things? How do they go from idea to reality? I call it the art of the follow-through, and these are the questions I'm dying to ask. Hi, Sean. Thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Deirdre, for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
Of course. You know, so we're here at roughly the beginning of May when we're recording this. And on the day that, you know, somebody listens to it, who knows where we'll be in terms of quarantine and coronavirus and everything else. But how are you doing? How are you hanging in there?
I'm doing well. So, I mean, it's a really difficult time. And as you said, it changes day by day and week by week. But trying to keep myself to a schedule as we all quarantine at home, I find that's the only thing that really keeps me sane these days, is to treat Monday through Friday like work days still, and Saturday and Sunday kind of like weekends, and try to get some level of normalcy.
Have you gotten to the point where you just have no idea what day it is sometimes?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's, all the time. Yeah, I know. They all seem to blend together, unfortunately. But I think keeping a schedule really helps right now. It's helped me, and I think it helps a lot of people at home right now to try to do that. And treat the 9-to-5 like the 9-to-5.
Yeah. Do you have a guilty pleasure during quarantine?
Ooh, that's a good question. I found these amazing avocado ice cream things.
Oh, that sounds kind of cool.
Yeah. It's I found it at Sprouts, the grocery store. They've got this really interesting avocado ice cream, and I'm eating more ice cream than I ever have, as I'm sure a lot of people are.
Absolutely. I'm excited to get to talk to you, because you have, like, there are like 5 different podcasts I could do with you about your life, and you're only 29, so hang in there for a few more years and I'm sure I'd come up with 10 more podcasts to do. But you're known for a number of things. Probably the headline that usually comes up on a Google search with you is that you got a perfect score in the SAT. And it pretty much changed your life. So let's talk a little bit about kind of where you and your family came from and how your very much American success story started.
Yeah, I love that you're starting with that, because that's exactly what I think about when you hear about, or when I Google myself even, the first thing I see is perfect SAT score, success story.
Which is not a bad thing to have come up.
No, not at all. But, you know, like every success story, there is kind of a backstory and a grind to getting there. And so, you know, even for myself, my parents immigrated from India to America in the 80s. They only had $70 in their pockets when they came. And they moved to Las Vegas because my dad was able to get a pharmacy license in Nevada. And
And that's an interesting point, because what a lot of people don't know is if you're a professional in another country, like you're an engineer, you're a doctor, you can't just start doing that in another country necessarily.
Exactly. So they actually originally moved to Chicago, and Illinois wasn't giving out licenses to foreign pharmacy graduates. And so my dad and mom actually worked everywhere from call centers to Burger Kings while my dad was actually a licensed pharmacist. And so when he saw that the opening was there in Nevada, they moved right away.
Right.
Yeah. And so eventually they decided to buy a small little motel in Las Vegas. And it's not like, the big casino, really glamorous
They
or
didn't buy
anything
the
like that.
Tropicana at the
No.
time.
It was really kind of a seedy motel, and
And
but that's when
why would they do that?
it's a good question. And they were ready to, once my dad had saved up enough money from being a pharmacist, they were ready to purchase a house. And then my dad talked to one of his friends who owned a motel. And he encouraged him to buy the motel because we could both live there, like in a house, as well as generate revenue. So that was kind of like the entrepreneurial spirit that was like, I was born into that,
Right.
from a very early age. Because even my dad was thinking about, well, how can I turn where I live into revenue generation? And so basically, I grew up in this small little two-bedroom attachment to the front office of this motel. And Las Vegas, as you may know, is not the best place to go to public school. We have, unfortunately, one of the worst school districts, public school districts in the nation, is a 40% dropout rate. As you can imagine, a lot of kids decide, if I could make $70,000 parking valet cars at Bellagio, why would I go to college?
Or dealing blackjack.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. When I'm 16, or as they get older, they can deal blackjack, but valet they can do at 16 years old. And so it's not ex education isn't a top priority. And so I was pretty much clueless at the time about standardized tests, about the college admissions process, scholarships. But my family did instill that importance of education from within the home. And so I knew that it was important to go to a good college. And one of the ways that I knew that you could do that is get a high SAT score. And the first SAT I ever took, I didn't do so hot. I only got around average.
By the way, this is my favorite part of your story, is that you didn't do, well, as you put it, so hot the first time around. Like, you got a really average score. It was a good score, but it wasn't a perfect score.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what has actually helped me be able to relate to students in our courses and my
It makes
books,
you
etc.
very normal. I mean, until the perfect score part, but it makes you very approachable, I think.
Well, I think if I was just some genius that immediately started with a perfect score, I wouldn't be able to relate to anyone or be relatable or reproducible,
No, people would
right?
hate
Yeah, exactly. And so I wasn't that at all. But what I decided to do was basically lock myself in the library for an entire summer between sophomore and junior year with 20 practice SAT exams, and literally break down every question, understand why I got it wrong, why I got it right. And eventually, I developed amazing strategies that got that perfect score.
So,
And
can you
just for
explain the
the.
strategy part of it? Because you always hear that it's the way you could be really, really smart but not be a good test taker. So, what is it that you learned breaking down those questions that turned into strategy?
Oh, absolutely. Because I was that student that you just described. I was a good student. I got good grades. I just didn't do well on standardized tests. And I bet that's 80 to 90% of parents is children that are listening to this, right? And so when I was breaking down the test, I noticed certain things. For example, on the SAT essay section, I realized that I could write basically the same essay every single time using a template, and I would get a perfect score every single time on the
No
essay.
way. What it was your essay about?
It was so what I realized is if you drop big vocabulary words, I put things like the presupposition, I put all these large words, I knew the reader immediately was going to give me a high score. And I figured that out in high school. And so then I developed this template. And now we still teach that template to this day, you know, over 10 years later at Prep Expert to students, and they're still getting perfect scores. And so like there's these essay templates. I figured out on the math section, like, have you ever thought about why an algebra teacher never gives you a multiple choice test?
No.
Well, the reason is because you could just take all those choices, the numbers and the answer choices, and plug them into the algebra question, and then you don't have to do any algebra. And so, you know, just plugging in the numbers.
To be fair, I haven't thought about algebra in decades, although my kids are now doing it, so it's starting to come back.
I'm sure your kids have thought of this, but
they will now.
It wasn't anything game changing, but eventually, as you you know, stack up these strategies that you're not using in high school, you're not doing in high school, your score on these tests can get really, really good. Mm-hmm. And so that perfect score, like you said,
you didn't go into it thinking I'm going to get a perfect score, did you?
No. Oh, that's.
I mean, what's that like?
That is a funny story, actually. The day of my test, it was pouring rain. And as soon as my parents dropped me off to the SAT test center, I walked out into this huge puddle. And I had Converse, like the cloth sneakers on. And so my feet got soaked. And then, you know, I was too embarrassed during the test to take my shoes off, like, and have bare feet. And so my feet were literally freezing the entire test. And I was like, I'm going to fail this exam. And so I kind of joke with people, like, maybe the secret to a perfect score is to have freezing cold feet.
To be incredibly uncomfortable going into it. Yes. I love it.
So uncomfortable. I did not think I did well.
So how did you actually find out that you'd gotten the perfect score? Because back in the day when I took the SAT, it would come, if I remember right, I think it came in the mail. Like, you actually got the test results in the mail. I don't even know how it happens now, but how did you find out?
They do it both ways. They do it in the mail, but I think before it comes in the mail, it's released online like a week before. At least when I was taking it, that's how it was. And so I was ready in the morning. I think it came out at like 6 a.m. or something. And so I opened up the website and I did a double take and I couldn't believe I saw like a perfect score at the end of it. And I started screaming, actually, because I knew what it meant for my life. And so my parents started running in the room. They thought something was wrong. And I was just like, screaming in happiness, like, oh, my God, my life is about to change. And so that was think about that moment, that's definitely one of the peaks of my personal life, because what it did for me is it got me into every amazing university I could have dreamed of. It got me $500,000 in college scholarships from companies like Coca-Cola, Toyota, McDonald's. I even met the president of the United States, and many people think they're like, oh, you met Obama? And I'm like, no, I'm not that young. I met George Bush. It was his last year in office, granted, but no, I didn't meet Obama. I met Bush. But
hilarious.
It was a really cool experience. And so
when you win the lottery, or say, let's put it in Vegas terms, when you win the big jackpot, all the relatives come out of the woodworks. When you get a perfect score, how does that influx of opportunity show up? How does it manifest? Do you like how I dropped a big SAT word like I was writing the essay?
manifest is one of my favorite words. it was crazy. All of a sudden, I went from the student that no one really knew at school to the student that not only did other classmates now know and recognize me, but then also all the administrators, the counselors, the principal, everyone was like, that's the guy that got the perfect score. And then I was getting scholarships, offers, opportunities, like, hey, you should apply for this one, you should do this one. And it was all like, I couldn't believe it. You know, like, how did I go overnight from just the average SAT score guy to the guy that's like the guy at school now? And so it was really special. And all of this is like, it's kind of crazy, you know, it's just one test. It's only one test.
Yeah.
It's not, but that test is so important. And so I decided I wanted to help other students improve their test scores too. And so I put my strategies to the test. I spent hundreds, maybe thousands of hours writing curriculum and writing books to you know, flush out my strategies into 100 different things that help, 100 strategies that
and
help
so
me.
And so, Sean, are you doing this while you're going to college then?
While I was in college.
And where did you end up going to undergrad?
So I got into some
everywhere.
I got into some amazing schools, but I ended up choosing taking a full tuition scholarship at the University of Southern California, which I do not regret for a second.
Good
because getting a full scholarship is, I used to tell students, get a high SAT or ACT score to go to the best college you can. And now I tell them, get a high SAT or ACT score to reduce your college costs as much as you can. Because as
advice.
You know,
yeah,
student debt is a national crisis, $1.6 trillion. People are more strapped for cash than ever with COVID. And, you know, being able to use your test scores to get college paid for. I read a statistic by the U.S. Department of Education. They did a study, about 60% of college tuition for high merit students gets covered. And so, like, it's totally worth studying for these exams, you know, and for a lot of people like me, you can get full scholarships, whether mm-hmm. it's a state school. I would tell a student, go to a good state school where if you have a full scholarship or a half scholarship, rather than go $200,000 in debt to go to the Ivy League. Like,
yeah.
it's just not worth it financially.
I think that's such great advice. My sister was very much like you. My sister, a great test taker. She did an amazing on the standardized test and she got a full ride. She ended up at a smaller school in Texas and then went on to become a lawyer at the University of Texas. She didn't pay a dime for her education. Nothing.
Yes.
You know, nothing. But there is the vanity part of it that I think for a lot of students is hard to ignore.
Yeah, no, that is difficult. But like you said, you just said your sister went to an amazing law school after. You can always do it with grad school mm-hmm. after. I mean, grad school is often like I did my MBA at Yale University after, and that's just 2 years, right? And so I also got you can get scholarships for that too and reduce that and. So you can get that vanity if you want from
yeah.
grad school. you know, I suggest getting your undergrad degree for as cheap as possible. And if you're a high merit student, try to get it for free.
Yeah, I think that's especially important information for the next couple of years is, you know, we come out of COVID hopefully soon. And like you said, we move into kind of an uncertain economy for a lot of people and for a lot of students.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, it's been amazing having after I basically put my strategies into a course, the very first course I ever taught, I only had, I think, 18 kids in it.
How did you teach it? Did you teach it in person?
Yes. Hmm. This was old school. We weren't all online like we are now. And so this was back in 2011 where in-person classrooms were not forbidden by the government. Right? And so,
I bet you even shook hands with your students.
Yeah, I did. I did give high fives and all this stuff that wouldn't be allowed today. No, so the
really
very first course I taught it in person. Yeah, an in-person class, and the average score improvement after 6 weeks was incredible. I took students literally every single week. I would see their scores improve 50 to 100 points, and at the end of it, they had a 376 average score improvement.
Wow.
Points, and that's equivalent to taking a student who's in the 50th percentile to the 90th percentile.
That's wild.
And so, yeah, I had parents knocking down the door for more courses. I obviously couldn't teach every course, and so I started hiring more instructors. We started taking it online so that we could teach students everywhere, and now we've helped 50,000 students improve their SAT and ACT scores, and they've earned over $100 million in college scholarships, and they've gotten into every university in the nation, Harvard, Stanford, Yale.
That's incredible.
You name it. And, so that's my favorite part is hearing all the success stories, not of my own, but from uh-huh. the students now. And it's just my favorite part, getting emails from these parents of students like, oh, my God, you know, my son got a full ride scholarship worth $200,000 or you know, my daughter got into Stanford. Like, those are, that's what makes this totally
Right.
worth it.
So
And
I know that's your favorite part, but there are all these other twists and turns that are my favorite parts too. So
Oh,
while you're doing this, you're still an undergraduate student, but as you start to continue with this, you know, side business prep expert, there's a point where scalability with any business, especially one that's showing a lot of promise, comes into play. And at one point you actually went on Shark Tank with this. How'd you make that decision? And who was advising you along the way? Like, who were your advisors before you got to Shark Tank?
Oh, that's a great question. So yes, you are right. The highlight of the company, which I totally left out, was I pitched Prep Expert in 2016 on ABC's Shark Tank and closed a deal with billionaire Mark Cuban, which he's been an amazing advocate, investor, and partner for the company. We still email updates weekly.
That's awesome.
I was emailing last night about the Paycheck Protection Program. He's on the U.S. Economic Council. I was like, you need to help me with this. And he's like, don't worry, et cetera.
Quick sidebar on Mark Cuban. He was one of the, I think, most interesting people to listen to in the last couple of weeks, because did you see that one interview that he gave where he said, coming out of this, employees may not remember how tough it was to work from home or to take pay cuts, et cetera, but they'll remember how they were treated by their employer. Did you see that interview? I found that so, it really resonated with me.
I think now more than ever, he's right about that, and that it's a true indication of two things, which is leadership and company culture. Mm-hmm. How companies are responding right now in terms of how they're allowing either, you know, keeping their employees employed or allowing them to work from home or whatever they're doing to help their constituents, essentially their employees, is really an indication of the leadership of the company and the culture you want to build. And those are going to be the companies that last. And so we're doing our best at Prep Expert to follow Mark's advice, which is to keep everyone employed, to keep everyone working from home and safe. And, you know, this is an uncertain time and you have to break the typical company rules that you may have.
All of them.
I'm like, yeah.
I mean, exactly. I'm recording this in my laundry room right now. I'm breaking all kinds of broadcasting rules.
But it sounds amazing. Working. You may want to do more.
I might. I can do a load of laundry while I'm doing it. All right, let's get back into the Shark Tank stuff. What did you do to prepare for that? And what is the process actually like once you get there? What was your shtick getting into it?
Oh, yeah. So getting on Shark Tank is just about as hard as getting a perfect SAT score. And I'm probably the only person that's done both. And so it's, you know, 50,000 people apply to be on Shark Tank every year, and only about 150 to 200 get on the show. So the percentage is, I calculated it, it's both for the perfect SAT and Shark Tank, it's about 0.02%. It's so if you calculate both, it's like 0.0004%, but I don't want to do too much math on people. But
yeah. Why don't I sum it up for you? It's good to be Sean Patel. You got a good streak going.
I've been very lucky. Yes.
Well, and you also work hard.
Yeah, it was a preparation process. And so I was a fan of the show Shark Tank, and one day it just, a light bulb went off on my head, and I said, I've got a small business in Las Vegas that I'd love to scale, and I could use an investor to help me go to more cities, help me get more employees, and really scale the company. And then chance be that they were doing Shark Tank auditions I saw in New York City, which is only a couple hours from Yale University. And so I took the train down for the auditions to New York, and I'm late to everything. I wasn't late to this podcast, but I'm late to everything. And so,
I was.
And so I'm late to everything. And so I was like the last person in line at this audition. It was a 1-minute pitch to a casting call producer. And so I waited around in New York City for 9 hours for this 1-minute pitch. And the whole time I'm thinking, you know, why did I do this? This is so ridiculous. I took a 2-hour train down. There's no chance I'm going to get on the show. And then when I actually get to pitch the producer, he is not liking my pitch at all. He is stone cold. Like,
really?
You know,
what was your first line?
I tried to impress with like media and sales. I was like, oh, we have $1 million in sales. I've been in the New York Times, and like none of it is landing. And then finally, at the very end of my pitch, I pull out from behind my back. I've been holding my SAT book, and I see his eyes totally light up, which is, he's like, he can't believe I'm a published author. My face is on the front of this SAT book. And, it's the one that I wrote with McGraw-Hill, and he's just so, so impressed. And with, literally from that point on, I think it was 2 months later, I had a couple more like video auditions and things, but within a couple months, they were flying me out to LA to pitch the Sharks. And
wow.
So,
so by the time you made it on with the Sharks, yeah. What was your first line?
Yeah. Ooh, you know what I hate about my first line with the Sharks is I think they edited it. I think it was my second line. It was something like, I'm no genius, but I got a perfect SAT score or something. And then for the Shark Tank commercial or ad, they edited it so it says, I'm a genius. And I was like,
oh.
I know. And I was like, that's not what I said.
Oh, no.
I was like, I looked very arrogant in that commercial. But thankfully, anyone who watched the pitch knows that it was not like that. But really made my first made the first line look like I just came in the tank and said I'm a genius. I said I'm no genius.
That's
but
so funny.
Yeah, so with but the lesson in that, I think, to people is that I wouldn't have gotten on Shark Tank if I didn't already have the book. And so you have to like build your authority up slowly. It's not like I could have just jumped from an idea of a business mm-hmm. to Shark Tank. I went from my idea to starting the company to writing the book to then getting on Shark Tank. And so I think every entrepreneur out there, like, take those little baby steps as you go to gather more authority, and then you'll get bigger opportunities.
Exactly. You know, what you're talking about is establishing credibility. And what I love about your story is that you establish credibility incredible ways, because I get pitched on people all the time, and I love to go down the rabbit hole of like finding out what the bio really means. And I'll go to your LinkedIn, I'll do the Google. Like, I mean, I know more about you by the time I've done my research than you do. And there are a lot of people who are, especially these days with social media, they're able to make themselves seem like an authority without ever having actually done anything. You know, and I think that that's really good advice you give people, is to do the work.
Yeah. Oh, you have to. I mean, there has been nothing in my life that has ever happened that's good if I didn't put out an incredible amount of work, whether it was getting the SAT score, writing the books, starting the company, getting on for Shark Tank. I think I practiced and prepared about 500 hours, literally, preparing for every possible question they were going to throw at me, and just getting ready to have good. One thing that I think made my pitch particularly interesting, or my show interesting, is I made sure that I had interesting stories from my life to share with the Sharks, because I have the most boring business on earth. It's SAT. and I know that Shark Tank is an entertainment television show.
Right.
And so I don't want them to just cut my pitch because they're like, this is all SAT prep. And so I had some fun stories and some interesting, heartwarming stories to share with the Sharks. And I did that very purposefully. And I worked hard to prepare those, because you have to think about your audience anytime you're going on Shark Tank or a podcast, right? It's, you have to do that, and it's something that I think people can work on, building credibility and preparing, like you said, and working hard to get there.
Yeah, and knowing, like you said, whether you're in sales or you're an entrepreneur or you hope to build a business, who is your audience? Because you'll speak to them differently depending on who that audience is at that moment. That's such good advice. I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that I always often we work with different agencies, whether it's marketing or sales, et cetera, at Prep Expert. And one of the first tests that I do with agencies is I try to determine if they can figure out who my audience is. And if they don't get it right, they're almost written off in my mind, because my audience is very different. So at Prep Expert, our customer is the parent,
yep.
and our consumer is the student. And our consumer is the student. And so if a marketing agency starts pitching me on, well, we could do all this marketing to the students and blah, blah, blah. And like, they totally missed it. And, you know, they totally missed it. And so I'm talking to parents all day long, and that's who I need to be talking to and know my audience, right?
Right, yeah. Right. Did you have multiple offers on Shark Tank, or how did you decide to go with Cuban?
Oh my God. Yeah, so I went into the tank thinking that I would have multiple offers. I went in so cocky. I was like, oh, I'll take a multiple deal, or I'll take a partnership from Damon, Lori, and Mark Cuban. And I got crushed during the first, I want to say, half an hour of my pitch by the sharks. Kevin was not interested. Damon was not interested. Lori was not, were not interested. Robert, they all went out pretty quickly, and it was, had nothing to do with my business. They all loved the business. They loved that I had $1 million in sales. It was profitable. They loved the business. What they did not like is that when I was pitching on Shark Tank, I was still in school. So I was still finishing my MBA at Yale. They didn't think a student entrepreneur who was still pursuing to become a physician, and you know, they didn't think you could do both. And so, you know, I was really lucky that Mark Cuban jumped in at the last second and really believed in me that I would be able to continue the company at Prep Expert and become a physician,
which you did.
Yes. After Shark Tank, I graduated with my medical degree from USC, my MBA at Yale, and now I'm doing my dermatology residency at Temple University Hospital in Philadelphia.
What do you do for fun?
Work? No.
Because you're a fun guy. Like, you're so personable. You're fun.
I love to do whatever everyone would like to do for fun. Right now it's like Zoom happy hours, I guess, with friends, but typically it's going to be going out to dinners and drinks. I like comedy shows. But, you know, I regulate my fun just like anyone should, I think. I go out one or two nights a week. I don't do it too much because I'm usually focused on either residency or the company and splitting my time between the two.
Yeah. Do you ever think about selling off the company? I've got to think you've had offers and had people approach you on that. I mean, that would simplify your life. More time for Zoom happy hours if you do that.
I know. Yeah, it's not a bad idea. We've definitely had offers come through over the years. I think a couple things hold me back right now, which is, one, I want to make sure it's the right partner because this company is my baby. You know, I literally, it grew out of an idea from my mind, and I want to make sure that whoever, if we were to ever sell the company, that it's in really good hands. And then the second thing is, I'd always want to stay on as kind of the advisor, like an advisor or face of the company, because I think it is so attached to my own personal story. And I think that's what helps differentiate us from some of the other faceless companies like Princeton Review and Kaplan, is that there is kind of this persona. And that's happening a lot, actually, in companies in today's world, which is people are buying the stories, the personas behind them, rather than kind of the traditional model of these faceless corporate behemoths right. that we're so used to.
Yeah. How is what your company does different than some of those faceless behemoths? Which, you know, certainly those companies around when I was growing up and there were kids who would go and take the courses. What is it that you guys are doing with the way the company is right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a few things. One is we're making sure that you only that students only work with top instructors. So what I mean by that is we only have instructors that either got a perfect score or they got in the top 1%. So they're
how
in the
many 99%. Of you guys are there?
There's not a lot, and so we've got a handful of elite instructors to make sure that every student is learning from the absolute best. So some of the other companies, they'll allow people with 85th percentile scores to be instructors. And, you know, when a student is already scoring the 90th percentile, it's not a good situation where the student is knows more than the instructor.
Right.
It's that's one. The second is, I think the curriculum is written from the perspective of an average student who got a perfect score. And I think that, as you mentioned, resonates so well with students. They're able to connect with the curriculum, the books, the strategies, because it's not written from like this dry PhD in math or English that's teaching you kind of the basic mechanics of a grammar question. It's teaching you things like, hey, when I was in high school, I noticed the word being is always wrong on the writing section. And you should notice that too, you know, like that kind of thing. It's like really, really just like relatable, easy to learn and connect with. So I think that, and then obviously just the, it is a lot of course hours. So we offer 60 course hours. A typical prep course is like 20 or 30. So
is it online, Sean?
Completely online. Yeah. So it used to be 99% in person. Now we're 99% online. So, very similar to what we're doing now with Skype and Zoom, but we use a virtual classroom called Adobe Connect that actually works a little bit more like a traditional classroom where students can ask the questions to their instructor, raise their hands, interact with classmates. So it's as close to an in-person experience as you can get. And Generation Z, they're so tech savvy.
Yeah.
They're way better at using online courses and online classrooms than even me as a millennial are.
This is kind of a loaded question because, I mean, you own a very successful company that prepares kids for tests. But do you think we put too much priority on these tests?
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Okay, that's great.
Everyone expects me to say, like, you know, the SAT and the ACT are fair exams and, you know, we shouldn't be putting so much – or we should keep these exams. I'll be the first person to tell you they're unfair exams. I mean, those that prepare for these exams have a huge advantage, and oftentimes that is people that are wealthier and have more money to and time and resources to prepare. Unfortunately, it is the name of the game right now. I think it may change with time, and I'm looking forward actually to that time on when it changes. Unfortunately, it's really difficult to change because if you think about it, and especially this year with COVID, some schools are going test optional.
Yeah, and that's a big thing out here with the UC system.
And there's a lot of media attention to it. However, the problem with that is a lot of scholarships, including at these test optional schools, are not going test optional. So they're still awarding the scholarships to the kids with the high SAT and ACT scores. And so, you know, at the end of the day, you can get in somewhere, but do you want to get it paid for? And so that's the biggest thing, you know, like the Coca-Cola scholarship program gets 90,000 applications for 150 scholarships. It's really hard to narrow those applications down without a standardized measure. And so, you know, can we get away from it? I hope so eventually. But until everyone at the same time does it, there's always going to be an unfair advantage to the folks that did take the tests and did well on them. And so that's why I just encourage everyone to prepare for these exams.
Yeah, that's very fair. All right, I want to know your secrets on time management, because clearly you have some. How do you organize? What works for you?
Oh, that's a great question. So I have a little secret that I use, which is a magic list. And
what?
So, yeah, I know. It sounds fancy and
so you
fun,
did all
right?
This with magic beans and fairy dust.
Exactly.
Got it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Basically, what a magic list is for me is it's like the ultimate to-do list. So what I do is on my Apple Notes, or people use Evernote, I write down an hour-by-hour outline the night before of my next day. And so I always put the hardest task first as well. So today I had to mock up a new web page for Prep Expert. That's difficult. And so I did that first at 8 a.m. today. When I woke up, because your mind is freshest in the morning. And if you get that out of the way, you just feel so much more accomplished. And then in the last hour of the day at 4 to 5 p.m. today, I will I'll reply to emails, because emails are not the most mentally taxing thing. And I know people have a habit of replying all day long, but if you're constantly replying and responding to other people, you're not really making time for yourself and your own work. Be productive.
That is an excellent tip, because you're right. It's like Pavlov's dogs when you hear the little bell going off.
Yeah.
And you never really get your brain back in. And you're right. If you're working as an entrepreneur for yourself, you should come first.
Absolutely. And another big tip I have with going along with this kind of hour by hour schedule is like, let's say you want to be really productive. You have to write up a proposal. You have to mock up a web page. You have to do some writing of a blog that you want to do. I would suggest, and I know this is going to sound hard for everyone, but turn off the technology. So what I mean is like, I actually put my iPhone in a different room, so I can't even access it. I turn off my internet on the laptop. I load up whatever document I need, and then you will be amazed at how much you get done when you are not checking email, when you are not going on Yahoo, when you're not checking Facebook. That's, I mean, that is, the productivity will skyrocket.
That is really good. I love it. Okay. So one thing you and I share in common is that we're both first generation American kids, because you were born here, right?
Yes.
Okay. So we're both first generation kids. So I'm curious to know, what is the best advice your parents gave you growing up that maybe made you, after you took that first test, go, I got to figure out on my own how to do better? What was it?
I think it was, that they always told me two things come first, and that is education and hard work.
It's like
And
we
what
had the same parents. That's
they, yeah.
exactly what I was told growing up.
Really, that's,
Education first, yeah.
yeah, it's amazing. And so I think one of the big things that hopefully parents listening to this are taking away is that education starts in the home. I mentioned that I didn't go to like a private school or a boarding school. I went to one of the worst public school districts in the nation, and that you can't blame it on your school district. Your student can excel and oftentimes stand out if you have a worse school district. And so, I think you have to start it at the home. You have to make it a priority. And my parents always did that. And for me as the kid hearing that, it's really funny actually, Deirdre, is that when I was a kid, I just realized if I got A's, my parents would stop bothering me. So by 7th or 8th grade, I just started getting all A's. And I was like, then I can go play video games, I can play basketball, I could do all the fun things. But then like it worked because like they actually just had me getting A's all the time. And so,
Right.
and it's like, so I say to parents, bother your kids until they get A's and B's. Like, they'll be sure that if you let them do what they want, as long as they get A's and B's, they'll get you those A's and B's,
I love that. I love that. And
that was.
then let me like wrap up by getting some advice from you for parents, because very aggressive parents have gotten a lot of attention after the whole like college cheating scandal in the last couple of years. And so we've seen kind of the worst of parents and what they're willing to do to get their kids into those schools, going back to that whole vanity in schools thing. But what we also saw was a lot of kids who apparently had no idea what their parents were doing too. So I'm curious to know what you think today's college junior or high school juniors and seniors need to know about the college experience, and what advice you might have for parents as somebody who went through the process but also has a foot in the business of helping get those kids prepared.
Absolutely. My biggest piece of advice to parents is help your student develop internal motivation. And so what I mean by that is every parent or every student right now has external motivation from their parents, meaning my parent wants me to go to college, my parent wants me to get scholarships, my parent wants me to do this or that. And so what you need to do is come up with real goals for your student. Meaning, I had a specific goal. I had a specific goal. Like, let's say my goal was, or was, to go to USC with a full scholarship. That was my goal. And so you help your student get that goal. Does your student want to become valedictorian? Do they want to go to Stanford? Do they want to go get a full ride at Cal State? Doesn't matter. Whatever their goal is, make it tangible, and then have them focus on why they're doing what they're doing. Like, no one wants a high SAT score just for a high SAT score. What is the end goal? And if you can do that and help them create that tangible goal, you will develop internal motivation in your student. And when that happens, you don't have to badger them anymore. They are just going to be motivated to go to that SAT prep expert class. They're going to be motivated to do well on their AP exams. They're going to be motivated to do well in school because they have that internal motivation of the end goal, and it's no longer that external motivation. So my advice is develop internal motivation in your student.
That's really good advice, but let me take it one step out. Do you ever, okay. Would you like to have kids someday?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Playing the role of your mother right now. Let me ask you, do you ever worry that because your kids are unlikely to grow up in a motel in Las Vegas and go to a subpar high school, do you ever worry yes. that they might lack that internal motivation or be able to develop it because maybe they'll have a more comfortable life?
Oh, that haunts me. Yeah.
Okay.
It's not having the same struggle and then, you know, raising kids that are too entitled. Absolutely. I may just hide all the money, et cetera, from
yeah,
the
Yeah, but
kids
then they're going to Google you. They're going to see it.
I know it's the worst. I don't have a solution for that. I can only speak to the things that I know, and I haven't crossed that path yet. I guess I should ask you, how do you do it?
I don't know. I'm working on it. But I do think it's interesting. Like, kids are growing up in a different kind of world right now, and even different than the world that you grew up in, where there is, you know, any answer is at their fingertips. There is not a lot of delayed gratification for anything. And I'm taking it beyond the tangible things. Information is at your fingertips and you can access or have something delivered in an instant. They're growing up in a very different world, but also with a lot of different pressures. So
yeah,
I think it's interesting when you talk about...
The number one predictor of success is delaying gratification, actually.
Yeah.
Self-control. Number one predictor of success, if you can teach that, I mean, that would be my other piece of advice for parents, is to try to get your students to have more self-control and delay gratification. And one of the ways you touched on is to try to get them away from all this instant gratification they're getting from Instagram or Snapchat. Like, it's instant gratification to have a unlimited news feed of great content all the time. And so what happens to kids is they can't focus anymore on a textbook or something like that. And so it's a challenge, but I think turning off the tech will help. Helping them to learn self-control is the key, but I haven't figured that out.
Well, if you crack that one, go back on Shark Tank, because that's your biggest idea.
I love it.
So
too.
Sean, what's a good way for people to keep in touch with you these days and keep up with everything that's going on?
Absolutely. Yeah. So parents who are interested in getting their students to improve their SAT and ACT scores, definitely check out our online courses at prepexpert.com. And then if you'd like to follow me personally, I'm on Instagram at Sean Patel. My first name is spelled a little different, at S-H-A-A-N. And then it's P-A-T-E-L.
And then is the plan to practice as a dermatologist as well?
That's the million-dollar question. So my plan is to do both, which is practice part-time as a dermatologist. And you know what's really interesting right now with COVID is we're doing all these teledermatology appointments, and we're doing just fine. Dermatology is so visual. I'm excited at the prospect of, you know, this whole specialty being primarily an online specialty in the future. And so doing some teledermatology as well as some entrepreneurship, whether it be Prep Expert or the next venture. And if there's a next venture, I'm coming back on the show, dear.
Yeah, you are. Sean, thanks so much. I appreciate your time today. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, everybody, for the awesome feedback on last week's episode with Joan London. One of the common questions I got after it was, how long have you two known each other? The answer is like 45 minutes, because I had never met her before, but man, did I love talking to her. Just, you know, like one of those people you just have a good connection with. The second question I got was, what advice did you ask her for when you hit stop on the recording? This is what I talked about in the tag. That one I'm keeping for me, but it was really good. So do you have a second? Could you please rate or review the podcast wherever you're listening to it right now? We have crossed the 250 review mark on Apple Podcasts. Yay, us! You know me. All I now see is 300. I'm a total numbers person, and I could use just a little bit of help to get there. So if you have a minute, I would love you to let me know maybe what you thought of this week's episode or who you'd like me to interview next. I mean, throw a name out. If I can get them, I will. Look for the next episode of Dying to Ask next Friday. Thanks for listening today.